episode number 6. Episode 6 today we have, it's just me and Nick today. In segment 1, we are going to talk about the Before series, Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight, which Nick and I just saw last week. And in segment 2, Nick has an interview that he did with Mark Clark and Brian Senn, authors of a book called 60 Shockers, A Critical Filmography of Horror Cinema, 1960 to 1969. And it's a really nice, really good interview. Nick did this, and where were you, Nick, when you did that?
I was in Columbus, Ohio, at what we affectionately refer to as MillerCon, which is a lot of us get together, and as I spoke about in the last podcast, head down to Mark Miller's home and attend a movie memorabilia exhibition called CineVent. But mostly we just watch a lot of movies and drink beer and just have the time of our lives, basically.
Sounds like fun to me, man.
It's a great time. It's like, Disney World, basically, for us.
That's great. I'm glad you took the time to interview those guys. It's a really nice interview, and it looks like a pretty good book too. I'm gonna pick it up.
It's wonderful, absolutely. Yeah. A lot of love, a lot of care went into that. It's a great read. It's indispensable, really. It should be on any horror aficionado's bookshelf for sure.
That's great. In case you have just tuned in, this is your first episode. I'm Eric Marshall, and.
And I'm Nick Schlegel.
So just so you know, Chris Gullin is on hiatus this week, but he'll be back next week.
Yes.
So have you seen any good movies, Nick?
Apart from Before Midnight, which we'll be devoting generous analysis to in principal photography. Again, the thing I tend to do, Eric, is I'm a junkie for films, as are you. I've been watching a lot of films just on Netflix and stuff, but a lot of comfort film, like, for example, The Longest Yard, disappeared from Netflix for a while. And I don't actually have The Longest Yard, the DVD of it, but it's a treasured film from my childhood. The original, not the remake, the Robert Aldridge, Reynolds, prison football film, which was an absolute favorite film growing up as a kid. And suddenly I'm, boom, it's back in my instant queue. It was one that they got back. And so what have I done? I've watched like The Longest Yard 27 times the past few days. But that's just me.
That's really nice. That's awesome. That's great. I saw Man of Steel last week, which I thought was absolutely awful.
Sorry to hear that. Yeah, you mentioned something, but I wanted to talk to you about it on the podcast here.
So. Oh, man, it was terrible. It was... the action, it's funny, when I go to see summer movies, I don't really like action scenes that much. I don't like fight scenes, so I'm always like, ugh. When it comes to those. In this movie, that was the highlight. The fight scenes were actually kind of cool, some of them, some of the effects. And that's, Zack Snyder, which I guess he's good at,
Sure.
But it just didn't make any sense. A lot of it. Lois Lane is kind of... like, she just kind of pops up everywhere, kind of randomly. She's in an airplane. She's at this thing with the military. Amy Adams.
I was troubled by the casting a little bit.
Yeah.
Nothing against her, but...
Yeah, he's good. The guy who plays Clark Kent / Superman...
Mm-hmm. He delivers.
/ Kal-El. Yeah, he delivers. His name is totally escaping me right now. But he's pretty good. It was crap, man.
I'm a little concerned. I mean, I will probably go catch a matinee of it, but in fact, I'm pretty sure I will, notwithstanding your harsh reception of it. I guess I'll go. And the main reason is because, and I don't know if I've mentioned this in previous podcasts or not, but my gold standard still for comic book adaptations is Superman.
Yeah.
Did we talk about this in a previous podcast?
We've talked about it before, you and I. I don't think so.
Just the reason being is just because the Richard Donner, 78 Superman to me was just, it was Richard Donner's direction and Jeffrey Unsworth's cinematography and Mario Puzo's screenplay, which was then, polished by Tom Mankiewicz and Marlon Brando and Gene Hackman and so on and so forth, 70mm. It's just such a grandiose, elegant, you know, presentation of this American, distinctly American icon, that I don't think anything's really matched up to it since in terms of that sense of Americana and, you know, truth, justice in the American way. And,
right.
And I feel if you're doing a Superman film, which is so, you know, tethered to that Norman Rockwell-esque view of America, that you're kind of betraying, in some sense, your source if you're going to try and do a dark, brooding Superman or something. Yeah. That's great for graphic novels and runs in the actual comics, and yeah, Superman comics or action comics. But in a movie, I think that's when you can really take what's great about the United States and really emphasize it and make the country shine where it deserves to shine. And both Bryan Singer's effort and perhaps even this new one, Man of Steel, I don't know, tend to focus more on a darker presentation.
Yeah, it's darker. It's they try. I mean, we already, my take on it is we already have Batman, mm-hmm, right? I mean, not everything needs to be dark. But the problem is, as far as the truth, justice, American way, that's not in there at all. Which actually, to me, is kind of a relief in a certain way. Mm-hmm. But it's got this huge death count, you know, like no one died in the Superman movies, original Superman movies, right? Or very few people, right, I think, right? There are buildings
trying to prevent massive death. Yeah,
there are buildings falling down, mm-hmm, and parking structures collapsing on top of
spectacle.
Yeah, it's all spectacle, and you don't really feel. I don't feel real connected, you know, to this particular iteration of Superman. I just feel like I don't really care what he does or how he, you know.
And that's what I think attracted us to Christopher Reeve in the first place in the role, is that we were heavily invested in him. We loved his Clark Kent. We loved his Superman. We cared about him. We cared about the characters in that film. To me, it's still, you know, one of the most amazing times I've ever had in a movie theater was sitting there and with my brother, and we believed a man could fly, you know.
Right.
It was beautiful.
Yeah, and it's, and you think about the villains too, you know,
Gene Hackman and Ned Beatty.
Gene Hackman
is
you know,
fantastic.
I mean, you know, these are guys that can kind of make fun of themselves, mm-hmm, and they kind of have fun with it. And of course, it begs comparisons. But it's one of those things, Nick, where I expected it to be bad. I went in and it was worse than I thought it was going to be. You know that it's going, that it's getting
I've
pretty
heard
bad
mixed,
reviews.
You know,
heard mixed.
I really have.
But you're going to see it anyway, you know. And,
yeah, I'm
going to
see
should.
It anyhow. And I'm a fan of Zack Snyder in general. And so I have heard a lot of mixed, and I'm probably going to find things I liked about it. I like about it and don't like about it. You know, I mean, the one thing that's been missing for me, they tried to do it with the Cliff Robertson character from the Sam Raimi Spider-Man films, but you can't really ever go to a comic book adaptation and say, wow, there's Marlon Brando. Wow, there's Gene Hackman. Wow,
that's
there's Glenn Ford. You know, like icons of American cinema are in Richard Donner's Superman.
That's true.
And you just don't see that anymore. Man. I mean, the closest they came to it was in, you know, recruiting Cliff Robertson to play Uncle Ben in Spider-Man.
Right.
And gracefully so, because he lent a certain class to those films by his presence.
Yeah, I agree. I also saw This Is the End the other day. You know that? It's who's not in it? Seth Rogen and James Franco and all those.
Right.
I didn't really know anything about it going
weird
in.
Weird premise.
It's
yeah,
so
the
weird.
The teasers and stuff are strange.
It's really strange.
Was it fun?
It was a lot of fun.
Oh, great.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of guy humor, you know, a lot of jokes about masturbation and stuff like
Sure.
But Michael Cera is hilarious.
Is he good? Okay,
in this
good.
Film. He's snorting coke and doing all kinds
really?
Of ridiculous
so
things.
Totally.
It's so stupid.
Very cool.
It's so stupid, but it's, you know, it's worth wasting $5 on a matinee and going to see. It was just,
this
I like James
end.
Franco because a lot of people don't, but I like him because he's willing to just kind of do all kinds of weird stuff and still try to do some of his more serious stuff. So, yeah, I enjoyed that. That was pretty good.
Well, fantastic. Yeah, apart from just my Netflix, daily Netflix excursions into films I've already seen 100 times, I haven't seen anything outside of our principal photography subject.
Hey, Nick, didn't you want to give a shout-out to some people?
Yeah, I did have a special shout-out to say. I wanted to thank Eddie Samuelson and Eric Cohen of the Cinephiles and just give them a lot of love in return because When I was in Manhattan for the conference, the Music and Moving Image Conference a few weeks ago, Eddie, a close friend, basically, you know, had showed me such a great time in New York. And they had me out to Eddie's place in Brooklyn, where Eric had set up an interview with me about my forthcoming book, Sex, Sadism in Spain, the Spanish horror film, 1968 to 1977. And we did, you know, a 30, 40 minute interview on the rooftop, the penthouse of Eddie's place, and it was, you know, just a great time. We barbecued and had a great meal. They interviewed me about the book, and that interview has just gone live on their website, thisisinfamous.com. It's called Brunch with the Cinephile, Spanish Horror Special with Nicholas Schlegel. That is me. And although I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, because we're recording this podcast, I did look at the first minute or two, and it was just, yeah, it looked fantastic. So I just want to send some special love to those guys and for everything that they do. The Cinephiles is truly a remarkable group dedicated to, you know, cinephilia, basically.
Yeah, sounds good. We'll definitely link to that on thatsarapshow.com on the show notes. I can't wait to watch it either. Photography. We are going to be talking about primarily about Before Midnight, I think, but about the whole Before trilogy. If you haven't seen Before Midnight, there's no way that we're not going to give you spoilers.
Yeah, it's impossible to discuss this trilogy without discussing the first two films.
Yeah, so. And without discussing the end of the Before Midnight. So
pause the podcast and go watch some great movies.
Yeah, and then come back and listen. But okay, well, welcome back. Okay, so we saw it on the same day, but not at the same, not with,
that's
not
right.
Together, right?
That's right. I went with Don in Royal Oak.
Yep, and I went with Rebecca in Ypsilanti. So, but we saw it probably at the same, almost probably the same time.
Yep.
But we haven't talked about it, and so it's been about a week, and I have a lot of thoughts about it. I'll just be honest with you. I wanted to walk out of the theater and walk back into the theater and see it again immediately. I really just,
even though you knew it was going to be an emotionally draining experience.
Yeah.
And that says a lot.
Yeah.
Because the film, it puts you through the ringer. I mean, you're right there in the driver's seat with these two, as they go through the ups and downs and highs and lows of this time, their time in Greece. So that says a lot that you're willing to just walk right back in, pony up into the chair and sit down and watch it again. But it was magical.
Yeah.
It was magical. Greece, I think, lent a lot to that. I mean, I'm not sure what we want to start talking about Before Midnight.
I don't know either.
But, you know, I guess we could start with just a summary of what this film's about in relationship to the previous two.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good idea. We could start with some background, you know. So before Sunrise came out in
94?
I want to say 94. I think that sounds right.
Yes. I think 1994.
That was Henry Cavill in Superman, by the way.
Oh.
In Man of Steel.
English actor, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. So before Sunrise was 1995.
95, okay.
And
which makes sense. Then 2004 would be Before Sunset, then.
It would be Before Sunset, which is nine years later, and then 2013 is Before Midnight, which is nine years later. And as you all know, because you've seen them all, it follows these two characters who meet in 1995 on a train and talk about all kinds of interesting things, philosophies, life, stuff like that. They kind of fall in love. I guess they do fall in love. And they make a promise to meet 6 months later at the train station where they part.
This is the end of the first film.
That's the end of the first film. And it's about a 24-hour period, not even a 24-hour period, an 18-hour period, set in Vienna. beautiful. That was 1995, and so there's this cliffhanger of, like, you don't know what happened. It really kind of leaves you hanging. Let me ask you, Nick, when do you remember when you saw Before Sunrise, the very first one?
Yeah, just recently with Don. I had not seen it until I sat down and watched it a couple weeks ago with Don.
Oh, you hadn't seen it at all?
No. Oh. I was a before virgin.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, which is odd because I was I'm a huge Richard Linklater fan.
Yeah, yeah.
And Don had been after me for years to watch them. And
I had no idea.
Yeah. Oh, no. I did a marathon, and then I watched them again.
So this is all really new to you.
This is very new
for
me.
Oh, this is great.
I mean, but the funny thing, of course, is that it's been, it's been a film. They've been two films that I've been dying to see forever and ever, and have actually caught glimpses of and clips from and watched bits and pieces. But I did not watch them in totality until recently. And, of course, the really funny thing about just a brief digression about that first film is in 1992, I was on that very same train.
Oh, really?
Heading from Budapest, which is where they started there because she's visiting her aunt or grandmother in Budapest. I was on that very same train from Budapest to Paris with my grandfather. Was it eight? No. It was 89, I think. Actually, yeah, it was 89. Sorry. Because Hungary was still a communist.
Okay.
Because the guards on the train had Uzis.
Wow.
As they checked, because I had to have a visa to get into Hungary at that time. And it was in 89 that they were in transition over to a democracy and capitalist economy. So I was on that very same train. And Billy Graham had come in and done a major, unless I'm mixing the years up. I mean, I could be wrong. It might have been 92. I guess it's irrelevant. But Billy Graham had come in and done a major, Billy Graham event at the football stadium, in Budapest. And so this train was overbooked. And it was just, impossible. My grandfather, being, 78, 79 at the time, was able to sit down. But I was not in the hallway of the cart, those narrow hallways in the train, but I was in the in-between the two cars, that little station there. And I met this girl from Ohio, really cute, a teacher, blonde, really petite little thing, brown eyes, long blondish hair with like brown streaks in it. And we hit it off really well. We even went to the dining car, and we were smoking and drinking some beers and stuff like that. I remember I had to go back to my grandfather and get some money because I was like, I ran out of money and stuff. And he was giving me the wink, like, how are things going? And we were about 8 hours, together. And we made it into Vienna because Vienna is only a couple hours from Budapest. But she got off somewhere around something like Salzburg, or maybe we were into Germany at that point. Maybe she got off in Frankfurt. I can't remember. And that was the end of it. I think I took down her name and number. I'd have to look my little old black book. But, oh, my God, did the flood of memories hit me when I was watching Before Sunrise, because I had lived a very similar experience. Now, I didn't have, the gumption to propose to her what Jesse proposes to Julie Delpy in this film. But so it was pretty shocking parallel.
That is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's same train, same type of thing.
I think that that's amazing, and I think that what is probably going to draw us both to these films is similar things like that. That's uncanny.
Yeah, it is uncanny.
But I think that there are things that kind of ping with each of us with this with this movie. So I mean, if you were blonde in 1989 and on a
either that or 92, 92. And you remember me,
drop us a line.
Yeah,
that's
I think you were from Cincinnati or something, and you were so cute. And I didn't proposition you the way I probably should have.
So all these years later, hey, oh, that is great. You just made me totally lose track. That's wonderful. So you know that terrain really well.
I do.
Not just physically, but emotionally.
And Vienna really well. And of course, my grandfather lived in Vienna. Mm. And so I was really feeling their relationship as it unfolded in front of one of the most romantic cities. Mm-hmm. Vienna is not often thought of, or Austria in general, as Venice and Paris and Rome.
Sure.
But yeah, Vienna and the Ring and the general ambiance in Vienna is truly unique and you know, wonderful, wonderful to behold.
Yeah, I've never been, but I've always thought of Vienna as one of the main characters of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the movie. I don't know when the first time I saw this movie was, to be honest with you. It wasn't when it came out in 1990, what did we say? Five. It was, but it wasn't much long after that. So it must have been, I probably saw it in the late 90s. Yeah, a couple years later. So it's pretty close to the time. Looking back now, I just watched it again this last week. It's so... They're so young, Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy.
No, they're babies.
Yeah, they're totally babies. And I remember watching them walk around and thinking, you know, this is like really touching and interesting. And it's really easy to watch this movie, I think, probably. I think some people do and say, oh, they're so pretentious or whatever. But it's cute. And it's they have this nice relationship. And, you know, it doesn't give you this really tidy ending, which I like a lot. And, you know, who hasn't thought, you know, some of the things that they thought, you know, and so for me, I was closer to the age, you know, when I first saw
sure.
it, you know, looking back now, you know, you're kind of a little more cynical, right? Which will bring us to the third movie. Don't worry. But speaking of cynicism, so Before Sunset, I saw in the theater. I saw it the Maine when it came out mm-hmm. because I loved Before Sunrise. So I saw Before Sunset when it came out in 2000.
Which finally gets around to answering the question.
Right.
Did they meet six months later?
Right. And, you know, as all of you know who have seen it, the answer was no. Neither one of them went for different reasons.
No, he did. He does go.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Jesse does go.
Jesse goes. She doesn't, but they don't
because her
meet.
Grandmother dies
right.
that day.
Right.
So she was at a.
That's
a,
right. Yeah.
He originally says he wasn't there, but then
right.
You know, some conversation. He lets a few things out, yeah. And she's like, "He's like, okay, I was there."
Yeah.
And he's like, "You know, I went in Dutch and borrowed all this money from my father and right. you know, and you weren't there."
Yeah, which is great because it shows him like in the first movie and I think in through the second movie he's the romantic. He's the one that believes that, you know, these things can happen and it makes sense that he would do that. It's I like the second one. It's very short.
Oh, that's Don's biggest problem with it. He's like,
yeah.
Oh, I love Before Sunset.
Yeah,
it's just 85 minutes or
I
something.
Know.
You know, it's like
and it's
sort of like the middle act. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But I don't think, I mean, I don't know. I haven't read a whole lot about this. I don't know if, I know when they made Before Sunrise, I doubt that they plan to make Before Sunset.
I've seen Linkletter say in print that it was not, they had no intention.
Yeah.
He kind of had thought about what might happen. And
right.
And it just, I don't know, schedules freed and they,
yeah.
they found, you know, and it was like, bingo, it was like serendipity struck. And,
yeah, and I know that Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke wrote or co-wrote much
sure.
or most or, you know, maybe almost all of the dialogue.
We should probably pause here and just say that one of the most unique attributes about these three films are these, you know, very long takes, very sort of, I mean, Linkletter sort of channeling a lot of the French, you know, Nouvelle Vague, the French New Wave directors in these long protracted takes that
yeah.
sort of like keep you sutured into the scene. Not, you know, there's no cutting going on. They're single takes. And it's like, absolute exquisite improvisation on the part of the two
yeah.
actors. Never once is there a false moment between them.
Yeah.
And of course, these are like 9-10 minute, well, as long as a magazine would hold, right? At the 1,000 feet of film,
yeah.
right? So like 10 minutes of film. Absolutely exquisite performances.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah.
you know, sometimes this turned out to be one of the principal complaints from the public was that, you know, it's a bunch of people walking around Vienna. I have no interest in seeing that. A bunch of people walking around Paris.
Right.
But I mean, if you've ever, I don't want to sound pretentious, but like I think if you've been in a relationship, even just a friendship, you know that that's what people do. And so when I mean, it strikes that sort of that chord of familiarity within you, I think that's ultimately why these films have such devoted, loyal fan base.
Yeah, I think so too, and it's within Linklater's kind of
yes.
aesthetics too. If you've seen Slacker, right? I don't know if the microphone's picking up that dog next door, but my neighbor's little yappy dog's yapping. So, but anyway, Yeah, I think, you know, if you've seen Slacker, it's just a bunch of guys walking around Austin, you know. So it's part of the aesthetic. But, yeah, I agree, those long takes, the improvisation. But they wrote a lot of the dialogue, too, because they know the characters. And I thought that was really nice. But I remember, I didn't remember it being so short. When I rewatched it last week and it ended, I was like, what? It's it? Yep. I'd forgotten, you know.
It's like, boom, and, yeah.
It's great, though. They're talking, in that one, they're walking around Paris the whole time. And he, and I love this. The conceit that he writes this book about their meeting in Vienna, and she comes to the reading, and he says that he wrote it basically for her, although he's married with a child, right? But and he ends up staying in Paris. So then you flash forward another 9 years, and we're at Before Midnight, which is set in Greece, like you said, and it takes a little bit of a turn.
Oh boy.
Yeah. You know, it takes a turn for sure. It's got the same, the dialogue has the same power.
Sure.
But the relationship has, again, spoilers, is, you know, they're together. They have twin daughters. He's still got his son who's going off somewhere else to your,
which was probably genius for Linklater to start the film, because then his ghost hangs over the whole film, basically.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
He starts the film off with Jesse by himself in the Greece, like the Athens airport or something, saying goodbye to his son. And there's this moment where the son says, you know, I don't bother really flying in for this recital that I'll be involved with. And, you know, he's crushed when he hears this.
Yeah.
Because he loves his son very much. And there's a fair amount of guilt already inside him for being kind of an absent father, for having his midlife crisis, essentially, but it's not a midlife crisis. He's just fulfilling something that perhaps began when he was 24, yet at the cost of throwing away a marriage. But he admits a very unhappy one. So, I mean, it's rife with all sorts of problems that assault us in life. And that's why I think it hits home to so many people. Yeah. But I guess what I'm trying to say here is that he says to his father, when you come back, it'll just piss mom off if you're there, and then I'll wind up getting really depressed and upset because you're there, you're both there, and you're fighting. And it's like that kind of like hangs over the film. And then on this very long, now that they're not constricted to a magazine of 1,000 feet of film, they can do these really, really long takes. Yeah. There's this real time drive from the airport to the place where they're staying, in sort of like a little resort area. Mm-hmm. Communal area, and wow, that is just incredible. That car sequence, holy cow,
it's so long, and you don't realize how long it is, you know, until pretty far into it. You know, there are some cutaways actually to the ruins when they want to stop at the ruins, but I like how he withholds, like in the very beginning of the film, Linklater withholds the twins and Celine, Julie Delpy's character, because there's this long scene in the airport, and finally he walks out, and she's there on the phone talking in French.
Yes.
They get in the car, and there are these two cute little twin girls with long, curly, brown, blonde hair. And that's when you realize, okay, they're together, there's twins. He makes you piece a lot of it together at first, which I think is a good move. But yeah, those tracking shots, the movement of the camera, but the way the movie progresses is it's subtle. You see a lot of it coming.
He plants a lot of the seeds in that car trip.
Yeah.
She's, you know, her job, you know, the job she's currently working, now she's going to be forced to do something different in her career, which makes her sacrifice some principles or something like that. But of course, she's going to do it anyhow. And he's trying to be supportive of her as she makes this decision. And then we switch over to Jesse, who starts sort of like relieving himself of the guilt surrounding his son, which she immediately internalizes and says, oh, what? Now you want to move to Chicago? You know? And he's like, what the hell? I didn't say that. But we know that the thought's in his head anyhow. And she's just voicing it. And then, man, things already, they turn dark right in that car. You notice?
Yeah.
They turn dark right before they, and then I think when they stop off and get some food, provisions for the night, I think they even say something about, I'd like to get out of going to the hotel tonight.
Yeah.
She says that, you know?
Yep.
And they're like, what the hell are they talking about?
Yeah, you don't know until later that their friend has got them this hotel room with massages and everything for a romantic getaway. But I mean, the movie culminates in about a 20-minute argument. I mean, basically.
Maybe 30.
Might be 30. And the seeds are planted. And it's one of those arguments that, you know, if you've ever been in an adult relationship,
oh, dear God.
You know something about. There are little misunderstandings or things from a long time ago that come up now. Things that have been brewing.
Resentment.
And all this. And for me, there are times, and I hate to admit this, but there are times where I felt like the Ethan Hawke character, Jesse, I felt like some of the dialogue and the arguments was scripted from me. It sounded like things that I might say.
Oh, that's Linkletter's gift, too.
Yeah, it is
his because,
gift.
Like, I felt the same thing. Right?
Yeah, you know? Right. No, and so it's realistic in that way, you know, and you can see arguments going that way. You can see them brewing over the course of a day or two, and you can see, or, well, in this case, even 8 or 9 years, right? And you see it come to fruition. And you see them saying things that you don't think they mean, and hurtful things, and it makes you cringe, but you know it. And I think that's what's great about it. And I think the other thing for me personally, and this is just there are a couple, like you had those personal connections in the first one with Austria and everything. I had two distinct things with this one. One is really simple. They mentioned a few times that they're 41 years old. I just turned 41 years old a couple weeks ago. So I'm like, oh, I'm the same age. No wonder I like these films. You know, these people throughout have been the same age as me. So I kind of get it. The other thing, and this is kind of off track maybe, but when he's a novelist, he's a fairly successful novelist. He's on his fourth novel, I believe, right? And at some point, he's talking about this novel that he's writing, and it kind of pissed me off because, as some of you know, I'm writing a novel,
mm-hmm.
And the genesis of my novel was it was going to be from the point of view of people who have different mental disorders. And one of them was somebody who...
I did not know this.
Oh, you didn't know this.
I'm like, oh, not because now I'm like, oh my God, that's...
Right.
That's,
it's crazy. It's a mental... One of the mental disorders was one guy always thinks that he recognizes everybody that he sees.
Right.
Right.
And she talks about the girl in New York, the woman in New York. Right.
Right. And so when we're watching the film, he's discussing his next book, this idea for a book, and it's almost exactly the novel that I am writing. And luckily my novel has changed a bit since I started writing it, but I'm like, come on, Linklater, are you spying on me?
I didn't know
what's
this
going on here.
You know,
I mean,
we haven't
terrible.
Talked a whole lot about your novel over the years, but I didn't know that. And I think the really funny thing here is that as he was discussing his novel with his two friends there in Greece, I mean, talk about, by the way, the perfect place. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a retreat that's being hosted by what we perceive as a published, a very famous author, basically.
Successful,
thank you. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea he's basing it all about on the waterfront. You know, on the waterfront was a central character.
That was really interesting. And
it was all had to do with on the waterfront, you know, these vignettes that he was painting. And I thought, oh my God, this is a great idea for a novel. And it turns out you've been obviously had the same idea. I didn't know this.
Just that part of it. Luckily, when he continues to discuss it, it's not exactly the same. But yeah, you know, well, you've had that feeling, right? Writing your dissertation. You're like, oh no, somebody else is publishing on Spanish horror or whatever it is, and you get all, you know,
you get protective.
A lot of writers have that.
How is mine different from that?
Right, exactly. I'm like, and part of me was like, why didn't I hurry up and write it? I've been writing this thing for over 2 years. You know, I had this idea almost 3 years ago. You know, I'm like, I should have scooped Linklater on this, but it was just one of those. It was really strange for me. You know, this kind of
that 30-minute fight is just grueling. It's a real-time fight that I've lived. You know, I was in a really, you know, powerful relationship with a lot of highs and lows for several years, and you just, you know, you relive these moments in such a powerful and palpable way, particularly since, like Jesse, I tried to be the voice of reason, you know, in some of these discussions.
What? You know, when were you the voice of reason in discussions
in a previous relationship?
Oh, okay.
You know,
okay.
I mean, I think we all, whether we're a man or a woman, is sort of gender neutral. But I mean, one person tries to be rational in a discussion, and in this case, it's Jesse.
Unless
and
you both think you're being rational, right?
No, man, I was being rational. And And
I like to think I'm the same way, but I don't know.
I mean, in the film, he's trying to say, like, I mean, he's like, you are the mayor of Crazy Town. He says to her.
Yeah,
you know?
He does say that.
And she is, I mean, she's acting off of her insecurities. I mean, they both are guilty of many sins, but she's acting directly from a well of insecurities and projecting what she'd like to see happen onto him. Although whether she wants to see it happen or not, I think she wants him to be the White Knight and save her from heaven. And of course, she explicitly states what these fears are later in the fight.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he's guilty of not reading her mind and predicting these things. You know, I mean, if it sounds familiar, it's because we've all been there. Yeah. And then I think his little, you know, time machine thing,
at the very end
was very sweet and also struck a chord of familiarity with me,
yeah.
Trying to do that sweet thing, but she calls him out on it. And says, "Yeah, this is very sweet, blah 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 blah." You know, but it's, good. But I mean, he's like, then he gives it and says, "You know, well, I'm just trying, man. I'm just trying, you know." And I mean, I think the essence of the entire film is in the still going. What did she say? Still going? Or no, still there, still there, still there, still there, still there. Gone.
Yeah.
As the sun is setting, is the sun setting on their relationship too? Is it gone?
Oh, nice.
That was my reading of that. And that I found that to be, it's this exquisite scene that just, it seemed to be some sort of commentary on the entire relationship.
Yeah, when they're watching the sunset.
Right.
Yeah.
And
the moment where she says, "It's simple, I don't love you anymore."
Oh, that was a dagger in my heart,
oh,
man.
Oh, my gosh.
Jesse and Celine, you can't be serious.
Right? And the movie does end in an ambiguous way. You know, you do get this because she comes around on the time machine thing. So tell me about this time machine.
As the camera pulls back and you're like, don't you fucking end it like that. I know you're going to end it. Of course.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
He does.
Of course. The argument about her not taking the job that she's been offered or wants to pursue. In the beginning, in the car ride, she's like, I don't know if I really want this. I'm not sure what to do. And at the end, she's like, oh, you want me to give up my dream job to move to Chicago? I'll be, next thing you know, I'll be buying peanut butter in Chicago.
Right.
Which I love that line. And he never asks her to go to Chicago, although, you know, he's thinking about it, like you said earlier. And that's one of those things where there's a lot of mind reading and insecurity and projection going on. But it is interesting. Like, that's one of the kind of, you know, there's all these movies play a lot with gender roles in some respects. You know, they're always talking about men do this, women do that,
right,
and all that. And the film is interesting in that, you know, she basically accuses him of being lazy.
Mm-hmm. And passive aggressive.
And passive aggressive. And you know, trying, you know, she's interested in environmental issues and also feminist issues. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's seeing him as this man who's trying to make her, you know, give up her dream and all this stuff. And to some extent, I have some sympathy for that because,
sure.
He, not that he's necessarily, I don't know if he's doing that or not. What I like about the movie is it's ambiguous.
Yeah,
you can read it a lot of different ways, but she's hypersensitive to that for sure.
Oh yeah.
And so you have that aspect, and I think there's some truth to that. You know, if you, I mean, they have two girls. She's worried about how the girls are going to be raised. There's an implication that he may have cheated on her at some point in Seattle or something.
And then he counters with her a perceived infidelity on her part, too.
Yeah, but it's not nearly as compelling, is it?
No, you're right. More attention's given to her accusation than his to her.
Because he won't answer her. And so that's kind of interesting, the gender roles in this. They look tired and old. They did a good job with the makeup. You know, when you first see Ethan Hawke, especially if you just watched the movies recently, like you and I did, he looks so old and kind of tired.
So young in the first film.
Yeah. Yeah. And she,
actually, you know, I got to be honest with you. Not to truly counter what you were saying, but I think in Before Sunrise, he looks very 22, 23, whatever Ethan Hawke was at the time. I thought he looked older, actually, in Before Sunset because he's sort of very gaunt.
And
I think Ethan Hawke's maybe a couple years younger than I am, so maybe he's 40, 41, something like that.
Sure.
I think he looks pretty damn good, actually.
I didn't say he didn't look good.
Oh, okay.
He looks old.
Old.
And he looks tired. you know,
his face looks tired. Yes. I think physically, he seems to be in good shape.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. You know, when
they're playing soccer, I'm like,
yeah. Oh, yeah,
good.
Sure. Yeah. No, just in his face. I think that's a lot. I think some of that's makeup to accentuate the age, you know.
Yeah.
It's a terribly depressing film. And
yet, why the hell did we want to go right back in and watch again? Yeah. I think a lot of it has to do with the first third of the film, which is like really... I mean, it's Linkletter is doing something that isn't really part of his, you know, his traditional approach. Is he's spending a lot of time focusing on visuals, you know, and I don't mean that, but I mean by visuals of a particular place, sort of an endemic culture. So while they're all sort of out there discussing his novel and the women are inside, you know, getting the meal ready, and there's we cut back and forth between these different discussions, and like you were talking about expectations of gender and gender roles and the types of discussions that they're having.
Oh, right, right. Yeah.
You know, that's not like a real, I mean, that's not, it seems to be like part of like Linkletter's oeuvre, you know. It's not like that immediately comes to mind when we talk about Dazed and Confused or something. You know what I mean?
Right,
it's like,
right.
And so it shows his growth, I think, also. And so I think for me, part of really wanting to go back in was the sort of ear-to-ear grin I had listening to a film talk about the humanities in such glowing terms.
Yeah,
you know?
That's a good point.
But then it just turns into this sort of like, certainly not the twilight of the relationship, but an early stages of an autumn. And you know, it's they're at the stage where couples with less of a foundation split.
Yeah.
And I think that's explicitly stated when he says, look, that dude you fell in love with, that guy on the train, you know, he's right here.
Right.
He's right here. And we can find what we had again. You know, we're just a little lost right now.
Yeah, yeah, he's definitely willing to keep it going, which I think is consistent with her character throughout. You know, Chuck Tryon has a good reflection on this on his blog. We'll link to it on the show notes at thatsrapshow.com. But one of the things he mentions is that he talks about the mobile camera, but in that fight scene, the camera, it becomes stationary.
It's locked down.
Yeah, for most of it. You know, and that's really interesting.
Straight
too.
Cuts, yeah.
Right? Yeah, which I don't know if Chuck makes this connection or not, but he kind of, you know, it's the relationship slowing down, maybe stopping as well.
Oh, that's
right.
Yeah, becoming static.
You know? Yeah,
truly
becoming
static. Yes.
You know, that's where it, you know, it's all in that kind of
posh hotel
room, right?
It's a great comment.
So you get the sense of they're really at a decision point, right? And of course, you know, you think about Before Sunrise, he didn't plan to make Before Sunset.
Right.
Makes Before Sunset. I don't know if he planned on this one, but this one it seems like he's really like thinking about, well, what are we going to do in 9 years?
Right.
Because he leaves it open. It's a terrible moment in their relationship, you know, and this is something you don't see in the cinema that often, right? I can think of a couple. Blue Valentine comes to mind as a movie about a breakup, about a bunch of people arguing, and it feels like real.
I can think of
a
couple examples of which I want to talk about.
Okay, yeah, great. But yeah, the ambiguity at the end, I think. Yeah, I wonder if he's opening up for, you know, for another one.
If he does,
it doesn't matter.
I think it would be a relatively happy one. I think it would be a return to Before Sunrise. I think that
would.
I think ultimately.
They'll be 50. Right, they'll be 50,
which is when a lot. Yeah, I mean,
their daughters will be. What are they like? 5.
Yeah,
the daughters will be
about 7. Maybe,
they'll be in high
6?
School. Yeah, they'll still be
something
high schoolers.
Like that, yeah.
Maybe getting ready for college. Yeah, maybe.
I think if he does, it would be one that focuses on falling in love again.
With
I really
the
do.
Same person.
Yeah, with the same person.
I can
person.
See that. I can see that.
Yeah, I think it's a full circle type of thing because we're in the weeds with them.
Yeah,
and either they split, people split up, or they
yeah.
you know, may find that they're still crazy in love with each other 10 years later. Who knows? You know?
And they probably don't know how to write it until the time comes because
right,
they couldn't
exactly.
have written this when they were all younger, right?
Very,
they wouldn't
great
have
point.
Had that experience, you know.
I can think of a couple films, you know. One of course is nonfiction, which is the seven
yeah,
Up series.
Yeah, let's say the Up series. This is like the fictional version.
This is
of
the fictional
series.
Version of Michael Apted's Up series, you know, which we get to sort of like drop in every 7 years on the lives of a group of what's this called? British people, primarily English, I think, weren't they all? No, there was the one guy, the Nick, is from Scotland, and so I mean, we'll call them British. people, children, every 7 years. It started with 7 Up in the early 60s, and now we're on 56 Up,
right? Yeah.
Which just came out earlier this year. And,
yeah.
But I think the other film that does a beautiful job of this, and for those of you who know it when I say it, will be like, oh, I love that movie. Because I've never met anybody who didn't absolutely adore this film. And that same time next year, which was a famous play on the stage in New York, which originally had, I believe, Ellen Burstyn and, I'm trying to think of his name. Charles Durning, the recently passed Charles Durning. But then they made the film of it with Ellen Burstyn and Alan Alda in like 79 or something like that.
Oh, I don't know it.
Oh, it's fantastic. And what it is, it's about this man, Alan Alda, and this woman, Ellen Burstyn, who meet in a retreat in Northern California. He's on business and she's on her way to visit some people, or she's just come from a retreat at a monastery, I think. And they meet at this small place, this beautiful place in like Northern California, and they're both having dinner, and eventually they strike up a conversation over the opening credits, and they sleep together. And of course, she's married and he's married.
Okay.
And what we're able to do is they decide to meet every year at the same time next year.
Yeah.
And we're privileged enough to visit them every 5. So even though they're meeting every year, we get to see them every 5 years.
All in one film?
All in one film. Okay. And it's about 25 years of their lives or so are presented to us. They meet about 5 times. And what's incredibly fascinating about that is that they're never in the same place twice. Like when he's young and conservative, she's young and very liberal. And when he's older and more in having his midlife crisis and like becoming very hip and relaxed, she's a business owner and now very conservative. They're never in the same place twice. But they absolutely are incredibly in love with each other. They've met every year, and it's a really interesting statement about, you know, fidelity and marriage and can you love more than one person in your life? And I'll have to lend it to you.
It's
a great movie that everybody who ever sees it, no matter how old or young, always come away with. And you know, the Before series is very much same time next year. It's just same time every 9 years.
Right.
And it's real time
films.
Yeah, in real time. Because you know, they age 25 years through makeup, you know, in one film, but this is every 9 years.
Yeah,
you know?
For real. Huh. Yeah, I'll definitely look that up. You know, I think that's what stands out about this, seeing Before Midnight and Man of Steel in the same week. I mean, it really, there's a good big contrast there, right? And this, you know which one's going to get the bigger box office, obviously.
One feels more like a film and the other one's a movie. The old argument.
Sure. Yeah, if you want to go there with it. Sure. But this is when people will rewatch, I think, Before Midnight. Well, how do you think, do you have any reflections on how this fits in with Linklater's kind of rest of his career at all? I mean, it reminds me a lot of Slacker.
I think the Before series will be his, you know, sort of the hallmark of his career. I think people, you know, 30 years from now, when they look back on it, there's going to be films, you know, like Waking Life, like we were talking about earlier, and Dazed and Confused and Slacker, and you know, particularly films where he was very invested in them. He wasn't sort of a gun for hire like in School of Rock, or I think he co-wrote
Bad
School
News
of Rock.
Bears.
Bad News Bears. There you go. That's a great example. Yeah. Bad News Bears. I think, you know, sort of the auteur sensibility is stripped from that somewhat because he's a remake and he seemed to be more of a gun for hire. But when we look at Linklater as a director and his body of work, this will be, I think, probably the crowning jewel, you know, because it's such dedication and you know, such craftsmanship, I think.
Yeah, I think so, which is kind of ironic in a way, because I think that a lot of it is the actors.
They write a lot of it,
but he's an actor director, you know.
True.
he often does that. You know, one of my favorite films, if not my favorite film of all time, is Waking Life,
right?
And we watched that. There's a segment in Waking Life with Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke, right? Post Before Sunrise, but pre Before Sunset, where they're in bed talking about some of the same things they talked about in Before Sunrise. And I like how he does that kind of callback. But Waking Life does the same thing, where you're going, it's very fluid, a lot of moving cameras, you know, it doesn't seem to ever stop. You know, Slacker does the same thing. Dazed and Confused does the same thing to some extent. But I think you're right. You know, I don't think a Scanner Darkly, which I love.
Me too, absolutely.
But I don't know that that's going to be the thing that, that he's known
fall
for.
Into his sort of his experiment. Linkletter is just a director I love. I just love his work.
Yeah.
I came to the Before party late, and regrettably so.
Yeah.
You know, I had been, it had been on my radar for a long time.
Don
and I had been talking about it for ages, and I felt terrible for not getting to them. They were always on the to see list, and of course, with Before Midnight coming out, we immediately got on top of that. And
in some ways, I envy you that experience. I think it's kind of cool.
Awesome.
You know,
it was.
On the other hand, I've liked living with these characters for the last 18 years.
Exactly,
maybe longer for me, 20 something, whatever it is.
Yeah, 20,
no, it's 18 total. Yeah, 19, so it's probably like 15 for me. Yeah.
It's I mean, I can't sort of recommend strongly enough to anybody listening. Well, if you're listening at this point, we've kind of like spilled the beans on everything here, but it still wouldn't stop me from saying you have to see these films. They're incredible. And, you know, they remind me so much of truly experimental narrative filmmaking, which, you know, but it's set in sort of a mainstream digestible aesthetic, you know, both thematic and so it's like it's not like you're sitting there, you know, watching, you know, Jules Le Jim or Breathless or films that are deliberately trying to break conventions of traditional Hollywood narrative.
Right.
Yet he is, but in a much more sort of like user friendly way.
Yeah, he's like, what's going to work to tell the story?
Exactly.
Instead of let's just be, you know, avant garde or something.
Right.
I think that's exactly right. He's trying to figure out the best way to use the technology at hand to tell the story, you know, in a way that's, you know, I mean, a lot of these movies he does for cheap.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he has to. So yeah, very good stuff. I highly recommend Before Midnight. I wish one of us had reservations or didn't like it so we could argue about it, but
they're masterpieces for God's sake.
They're so good. Yeah.
They're just fantastic. Yeah. I'm so proud to call them part of the American canon of filmmaking because they're just, I think, you know, we look back on the first two, you know, particularly the first one as, you know, so lovingly and with such fondness and as, you know, great films as little masterpieces of their own in their own right that I think in another 10 and 20 and 30 years, they're going to stand up there with the canon of truly great American cinema.
Yeah, I think so too.
Particularly since they've been so steadfast in releasing one every 9 years, planned or unplanned. So that's, I think we're in store for, you know, another installment. I think that even though Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy talk about how difficult it is to get themselves to invest in these characters every 9 years because they are so complex and it requires so much from them during filming, I don't think they can stay away from them.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. So I think that should wraps up our discussion.
I think
we covered what we wanted to cover.
Gotta stick around for my interview with Mark and Brian.
Yeah, stick around for segment two.
And welcome back to segment two of Principal Photography today. In segment two, we're going to be talking with Mark Clark and Brian Sen, independent authors of each other, who have recently teamed up and collaborated to bring us 60s Shockers, a critical filmography of horror cinema from 1960 to 1969. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
Yes, we're congregating down here in our good friend Mark Miller's house in Columbus, Ohio, where we attend a yearly movie exhibition called Cinevent, where we all meet and have an incredible time. We drink, we watch movies, we shop for movie memorabilia,
and we drink.
And we drink some more and argue. And that's basically what goes on here, and it's better than 10 Super Bowls.
Don't.
What I really wanted to talk to you guys about primarily was the genesis for this book, which has gotten, you know, very positive reviews. I have a copy myself and have enjoyed it very much.
I want to talk to you both about what was the genesis for the book. Why did you guys focus on the 1960s, and you know, what was your inspiration?
Well, it's actually quite simple, Nick. Mark called me up and said, "I've got a great idea for a book. Let's do it on the 60s. You do all the work, and then I'll take the credit, and we're golden."
And that worked out perfectly for me. I had the idea of doing a book on horror films from the 1960s, which was a decade that had not been covered before and in a comprehensive way in another study, and which is one of, or actually, in my opinion, the most interesting, most sort of richest, most diverse, tumultuous decade for the genre, and hadn't been covered before. But there were so many films to deal with. I mean, what did we wind up with, like 600?
Brian? Oh,
It was something on the order of 600 movies. Whew. And so there was no way I could do that by myself. So I had to find somebody who was a very good writer, who knew his stuff well, and was dopey enough to actually do this project with me. And that pretty much was Brian.
Yes. Well, I can see what you mean, Mark. The 60s, I often view the 60s as sort of the atomic bomb, you know, decade for horror movies. It seemed that the genre underwent so much transition in that decade, arguably more than any other decade.
Absolutely.
The sort of birth of the postmodern horror film, and the location of the antagonist as human as opposed to supernatural, really seemed to come forward to fruition too, with Psycho and Peeping Tom and some of the other major avatars of the early 60s.
Well, the whole 1960s were an era of radical change and evolution in the film industry in general. And the horror films were on the bleeding edge of that the entire time, with changes to the production code and pushing the envelope on the kind of content that could be in films and stylistic things, and you have a lot of European influence, and even European and foreign films coming in, foreign horror films beginning to become more prevalent in that decade, and just any number of different things that all coalesce in the genre during that period, as well as the kind of thematic things you were talking about, where, I mean, I think the nature of horror films, and the reason I like writing about horror and science fiction films, fantasy films, is that, they become these kind of repositories for, anxieties and aspirations, and so the social things that are going on under the in the subconscious and of the society always seem to bubble to the surface, mm-hmm. in the fantasy films, and of course the 60s were full of that. And usually your most tumultuous decades are the ones that produce the best horror films, the 30s,
absolutely.
The 60s.
Yeah, absolutely, like the 30s with the Great Depression. I mean, that kind of was the birth of the genre, and the anxiety throughout, the whole country was huge. And so how do we deal with anxiety? We make scary stories about them. We turn them into monsters, and we make pictures about them. So in the 60s are such a pivotal decade in cinema, because you come from the conformist era, Eisenhower 50s, and suddenly you're really in a cultural revolution. That was the decade of the 60s, and things exploded in many different ways, and it just got reflected in the cinema. And so it's a fascinating decade for not just horror cinema, but cinema in general.
Yeah. And you've got movies like, or issues like, feminism, or sort of a reaction against feminism comes up in a number of films. And then you get movies like Night of the Living Dead, where you have this kind of intergenerational and even interracial kind of conflicts and things, and crystallized in this, in this one story, maybe not consciously, but it's present anyway. These things just kind of show up, whether they're intended to be there or not.
Absolutely, and like Night of the Living Dead, you mentioned that. If one were so inclined to get a slightly bit pretentious, you could say like the zombies is kind of, the 50s are typically characterized as the kind of conformist decade. And the 60s was the personal me decade. It's like, we're going to do our own thing. We're not going to conform to the dictates of society. And you could see like this battle, the zombies is like the sweeping tide of conformity trying to suppress, the individuality of the survivors. If one were so inclined.
If one were so inclined.
Well, and you can read that film any number of ways. I mean, you can also look at it as, you know, the conflict, the sort of zombie conflict is a mirror for the Vietnam conflict, mm-hmm. and the different diversion of opinions about what the right thing to do is, you know, in that situation between generations, between, you know, it's, there's any number of ways to read a lot of the films of that in the 60s, but there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of subtext that comes into all these things, all this, the anxiety and the discomfort with all these different things, all these different changes that are all going on at the same time.
I think that's reflected in your analysis and critique of these films, which brings up another question is, you know, it's often very difficult tasking to compose reference books that balance critique, because distinctions of taste, particularly in this genre, will persist. So, what was the tone you were attempting to strike, and do you guys feel that you ultimately achieved it?
Well, I think the tone we were trying to strike in the book was Mark just wanted to emulate my style, and that would pretty much cover it. Now,
so I drove a spike into my head, and then after I dropped a few IQ points, I was able to do that.
No, I think, you know, the entries the entries vary in length, but typically a half page to a page and a half, depending on the merits of the film or demerits, as the case may be. For my part, I like to, give a little background whenever we could, throw in a little, you know, cultural background as well as like the production background, which can be fascinating because, I mean, frankly, some of these movies, the stories behind them are more interesting than the films themselves.
Right.
But there are a lot of great films, too.
And that's all true. Brian, it's funny because we, in a lot of ways, it became very very fortunate that Brian's the guy I selected to co-author this with, because we bring different approaches that really complement each other, because Brian would always be pushing me to add more production, making up type of background to the pieces, and I was always kind of, you know, pushing for more analytical and sort of interpretive elements to the commentary. But we're able to balance both of those and at the same time approach it in a way that was respectful, that was thoughtful, but that wasn't dry. You know, we're both fairly, we both try to be fairly, you know, light in our approach to things. And so there were a good balance there. So overall, I thought it turned out pretty well. You know, I wish there were certain entries, as Brian mentioned, you know, the entries vary in length, and some are pretty long, but none of them are really as long as they probably really deserve. Sure. I mean, it's not a book where we could do, you know, 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 words on a given movie. Sure. It was like Psycho or Night of the Living Dead or Rosemary's Baby or any number of other movies, The Haunting. You could write probably a whole book
easily
on that one film. So, but we did the best we could with
it fell
the
outside
parameters
the,
we had
those,
to work
I was
with.
About to say the parameters and the scope of the book. And I, you know, I'm on the same page as you guys. Obviously, I find it to be the analysis to be very thought provoking. It's the entries are laced with humor where appropriate. You know, your humor and your affection for the films is clearly evident.
For some of those films, all you could do is laugh. So yeah. Yes.
Exactly. And we're laughing
or cry.
And but one gets the impression that you guys are laughing with the film and not
yes,
at the
absolutely.
Film, you know, and that's a big distinction right there. Along those lines, are there any entries that you guys felt you were too hard or too easy on, or no?
Off the top of my head, I can't. No.
No.
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's pretty much, we call him like we sign, see him, and, you know, your mileage may vary, but this is how we felt about it. I mean, there were some that were harder to do,
right?
You know, mostly because, like a movie like Psycho, I mean, you know, it's like, I had that one, and it was like, okay, what can I bring to this that hasn't already been done 100 times before? So, you know, what's my take on this going to be that can be fresh? What insight do I have to bring to bear on this? And then there are other films that are like, what insight can anybody bring
right,
to bear
sure.
on Mano's hand?
Yeah,
exactly.
right.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, that's a great title. I guess I asked because, you know, in the nature of when you're ascribing some sort of like criteria, a benchmark for good or bad, sometimes when you look back at a film 20 years later or something, you may feel differently about it or something like that. Now, granted, there's only been a year really since, but I know that during the writing process, you might have revisited a film that you had seen 20 years before and had a different critical assessment of it, the 40-year-old, 45-year-old self as opposed to the 20-year-old self or something like that. So,
yeah, I think that's very true in general. I just can't bring any to mind right now that stand out. But,
I always say that I have relationships with films or other works of art, you know, and it changes over time. Yeah, I mean, I can see, I may have seen something that I liked a lot when I was a kid, but I may like it less as a, like in my college years, and now I'm in my late 40s, and now I have a family, and your perspective change, your life experiences change, and the work itself doesn't change, but what you bring to it, your perspective changes, and you get different things out of it.
Yes.
And you can get more or less out of it. It can speak to you to a greater or lesser degree, depending on, where you are in your own life. So the text doesn't change, but that relationship changes. And there were things that was like, oh, hey, I remember this being really fun. And then it's sort of like, oh, well, this was kind of a drag. And there were other things that you're seeing now were more, I got more out of.
Sure.
And the one I can think of that is like this, I wrote Gorgo mm-hmm. for the 60 Shockers books, and I was kind of dismissive of it in the book. And again, it was one that I remember liking a lot as a kid, and then when I saw it, I found it kind of formulaic and laborious.
Which it is.
But then I had the experience, since the book has come out in the last year, of rewatching it with my 4-year-old son, who loved it, and sort of rekindled that experience of, it's not a great work of art, and it's got these technical flaws, and the characters are sort of cardboard cutouts and whatever, but from the perspective of a 4-year-old kid who just wants to see monsters and thinks it's really cool that the monster's mommy, shows up at the end, and he was just delighted by the fact that the monster didn't die at the end of the movie, not to give it away. Sorry.
Spoiler. I'm so glad you mentioned that, Mark,
recapturing that with my son really made me think, I should have gone a little lighter on Gorgo.
Well, we're jaded and more cynical. We're older and we have a more, critical eye, and sometimes we forget. That's when we often, all of us sit down here, congregate and talk about films. Somebody may say something about a film that I know isn't great, by any measurable standard, but it's very special to me as a kid. So I'll be like, oh, I love that movie. I saw it when I was 7, and it has this whole
story. But when you're doing a critical assessment, you can't really, you try not to let that guide you.
How can you? You'd be screwed.
you have to be, try and be relatively objective. But nearly everything in life, it's all about perspective. And one perspective does change over time. I mean, it just does, no matter what experiences you have.
So you wish you could go back in there and put a clause in there that says, something like...
this entry written by my 12-year-old
son. For lack of a better phrase. No. But something along those lines is like, we'll ignite the inner child upon review.
There is actually one entry where I did that. My entry on Mad Monster Party, which is a favorite. Which is not one that really ever particularly spoke to me. But but my daughter, who's now 9, at the time I was writing the book, was younger, watched it with me when I was reviewing it. And so I gave my, I reviewed the thing and gave my assessment of it, which is that it's sort of Rankin Bass on a sub, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer level. And, but then I put at the very end, I put that I had watched it with my daughter and she loved it, and gave her reaction to it as well. So it's sort of like, I tried to address that when I could.
I saw Mad Monster Party at about 5 years old, and it was one of those fuzzy childhood memories where I could never really place the film in the pre-internet age of like the 90s. I'm like, what was that film? And I didn't have enough to work off of, even in terms of keywords to find it in a Leonard Maltin guide or something like that. But a girl I was dating at the time had a copy of it, and I watched it, and holy cow, I mean, talk about a time machine. When that came on, it was 1975. I was sitting next to my brother watching this film, and it nearly brought tears to the eye because, I mean, it was that powerful a connection to the film. So, I mean, obviously, I have biases all over the place with this film. It is, it's not without its faults or something like that, but it is forever. All my friends that know me and are listening to this know that Mad Monster Party is, it's one of my favorites. And I introduced it to a generation of my friends. who all as adults who all loved it, primarily because of Francesca. I mean, good God.
Well, the character
if you were a stick figure, yeah.
All over well, that. The character designs in that movie are all Jack brilliant. Davis, yeah. I mean, they're gorgeous.
But that's kind of, in a general thing, that's one of the beauties of films. I mean, beside of all its intrinsic statements and value for film is that it can actually bring you back to a specific moment in time from the past. I mean, just like a smell or, you know, a certain visual. Or
it's very true.
Sometimes a smell can be pretty similar.
Yeah, yeah, they could be intertwined.
Yeah, Times Square in the 70s, right? Yeah.
So, yes.
In terms of collaborating again and maybe tackling another decade, like the 70s or 80s, which are also really transformative decades, particularly the 70s with the economic business models and you know, economic paradigms that were shifting in the 70s with the birth of the blockbuster and the big budget horror film via The Exorcist or The Omen and things like that. Would you guys, you know, we could use some more of those. Would you? And you would be just the guys to do it. You know, I mean, I think, is there an opportunity to collaborate again?
Yeah, I think the 70s would be the decade to do it, if we were to do such a horrific thing. Yeah. But, yeah, because the 70s, like you said, that's another very transitional decade with lots of innovation and things in it. But this was a lot of work, and it took a long time. And, you know, we're not getting any younger. So, I don't know.
We have actually, I have actually talked to Brian on a very high theoretical plane about what 70s shockers might look like, and it would have to be very different because, you know, we mentioned there were like about 600 films in this book, and the 70s would be double. I don't even know, but yeah, probably double that. So it's going to be that would make it almost you know, it'd be a lifetime work for the two of us to do it. So if that project ever happens, and I'm not sure that it will, but honestly, but it would probably be more of a thing where Brian and I would edit the book, and we would have to have
we'd bring in
a number of other goofy people who want to work on it.
like me, right?
Yeah. But
and should that day come, you guys know how to get in touch.
but you know, we have other projects, you know, we've done since then and are working on. So I mean, I'd love to work with Brian again, but we'll have to see if that's the project.
We lucked out because, you know, our writing styles are actually very similar, and I think our sensibilities are relatively close, which so it made it quite easy, actually. And in fact, sometimes, you know, the book's been out for a year or whatever, 2 years, and if I thumb through it, I look at an entry, sometimes I can't even remember whether I wrote it or Mark wrote it. So. Wow.
Yeah, I wanted us to have each entry signed with our initials, and Brian didn't want to do that, I think because that meant all his entries would be signed BS.
Yes.
And then which is apropos.
And then the hate mail starts, too, right? Like, yes. And you guys can talk about who's getting more resentful mail, you know? So, you know, that's, I'm so glad we were able to take this time and sit down and talk about it for a segment two of That's a Wrap. I'm particularly in debt to my friends, Mark and Brian, because, I've been, made to feel so welcome as the new kid on the block at this event every year and really look forward to it. Like it's Christmas. It's a wonderful, wonderful chance for friendship and camaraderie and buying all sorts of shit at and getting gifts. And it's just an incredible time. And we'll have a link on the thatsarapshow.com. To 60 Shockers. It's highly recommended by the staff here at thatsarap.com, our chauffeurs and masseuses and the secretarial pool and the board of directors. All are big fans of it and cannot recommend it highly enough. So, Brian, Mark, thanks for joining us on That's a Wrap.
It's been groovy.
Keep it real, man.
Okay, we'll keep it real. Great, guys. Thanks so much.
Cut. That's a wrap.